Welcome to
Behind the Beat,
a podcast hosted by Sylvia
and Maya.
Sharon Lavery is a conductor and professor at the USC Thornton School of Music. She's the chair of the Winds and Percussion Department and serves as the resident conductor of the Thornton Symphony, Chamber Orchestra, and Wind Ensemble, as well as being the music director of the Downey Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
Professor Lavery, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It is my pleasure and honor.
First, I want to talk a little bit about your musical background. Did you grow up in a musical family? How did kind of your interest in classical music begin?
Well, I actually was the only musician in my family, which made it very scary to, you know, venture into this world of music kind of on my own. I mean, my mom played a mean accordion, and my dad was a very good trumpet player in high school. So there was, you know, some background, I'm sure, of talent, but as far as, you know, deciding to go into music for a career, this was something I just came up with solely on my own. You know, I don't know if you two had this experience, but when I was in elementary school, the instrumental teacher would come around when I was a little fourth grader, and he would demonstrate all the instruments that we could be a part of. Now, at this time, we didn't have an orchestra in elementary school. We only had band. So he went around and he demonstrated the flute, the oboe, the saxophone, trumpet, all these instruments. And when he got to that clarinet, what he made it sound like was, I mean, he just went from the low range to the high range, jazzy, classical, but I mean, it was just amazing. And as soon as I heard that, I thought to myself, I want to learn how to do that. Now later, I found out, much later, he was a professional clarinetist. So probably to my young ear, I heard what sounded, was, you know, was the best of all the instruments. But it didn't matter because I just knew that I wanted to learn how to do what he did. And then I also have a memory as young as fifth grade, being sent to the Westchester County, you know, all county band. I don't know, you know, you guys have regional all states and things like that. And I'll never forget it. I came from this little tiny band program at Roosevelt Elementary in Ossining, New York. And I get into this room filled with 100 kids, a little fifth grader, and we start rehearsing Strike Up the Band by Gershwin. And I will never forget what it felt like to be in the middle of this enormous and powerful sound. I mean, it was a sound that sort of shocked my system. And I remember thinking to myself, I've got to do this forever. Like this, I got to be a part of whatever this is. I've got to be a part of this forever. And so, that's how the whole thing sort of began for me. And then as I got older, it got into high school and started thinking about, you know, a career path. I had always had a passion for teaching. And I knew that music was something that I just couldn't live without. So I decided to combine the two and go into music teaching. And so that's where I went for my undergrad. I went to Michigan State University, which had a very strong program in music education. And so that's how the ball got rolling for me.
Yeah, awesome. I'm interested, so you have master's degrees in both clarinet performance and conducting.
Yes.
What was your experience like attending a conservatory versus a university?
Yeah, those degrees were quite different. My orchestral master's degree was done here at USC, like you said, and that degree I feel like was very academic. So it was very music history, music theory. My teacher here at USC, although it was conducting, he was very big on score analysis and theory analysis, and so I love that, and it made me into a better musician. That was great, but it was very academic focused, rather as opposed to when I went to New England Conservatory. It was all about performance. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the whole curriculum was focused on, I think I had to take maybe one music history class. I had luckily passed out of the theory. So, and especially coming from such a rigorous undergraduate program, I found myself with a lot of spare time, and I kept thinking to myself, why am I feeling like I have so much spare time? When I realized it was a curriculum that focused on go practice. And that's what I did. I figured it out. I thought, mm-hmm. they really want, this is about performance. They wanted us to take performance classes. I remember taking Paula Robeson's, you know, performance etiquette class, and like, just, it was all about performance. So they were quite different in that regard. I feel lucky that I had a hand in both environments. Right. Felt really lucky.
Yeah. So going back to kind of before you started university, You said it was a little bit scary going into a field that your parents kind of weren't exposed to, or that
Correct.
Was different from what your family had done in the past.
Correct.
How would you say that influenced your decision in going into music, and were there any obstacles that came with that?
Obstacles that came with choosing music?
Yes.
Well, I mean, what we all know is the elephant in the room is that the lack of jobs. I mean, it was scary. Knowing that this was a field that, you know, was potentially going to be hard to find employment. But I had such a passion for teaching. I knew that somehow, somewhere, some way, somebody was going to want to learn music, and I was going to be that person to teach them. So, you know, what, regardless of the outside obstacles, I just knew to persevere because I had such a passion for teaching, and so that's why I stuck with it.
So specifically conducting, how did you first become exposed to that in particular, and mm-hmm. how did you decide that conducting is what you wanted to pursue?
Well, to be honest with you, in high school, I was the drum major of the marching band. So that was kind of the first time, I don't want to say I picked up a baton, but it was kind of the first time I was actively in front of an ensemble leading in some way. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I thought, this is kind of fun. And then, as you know, I told you I went to Michigan State University where I studied music education, and part of that curriculum was having to take a conducting class, just like you guys. Mm-hmm. And so in that class, I remember loving it so much. I really think that's where I was really first bitten by the bug. I had a really good teacher, and I really enjoyed it. You know, of course, and then I just became more serious about my clarinet playing. You know, it was always in the back of my mind, conducting, but I wanted to be a serious musician first. And then I went to New England Conservatory to focus on my clarinet. But all the while, as I told you, they encouraged us to take classes that would enhance your performance skills. And so I took a conducting class. It was taught by Grant Llewellyn. I don't know if you guys remember, he was here a couple of years ago. Maybe it was before your time. What did he do? Mendelssohn.
Was it symphony? Or?
No. It was the C preludes. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. He was a fantastic teacher, and I loved the class. I took another conducting class from Frank Battisti, who was the Wind Ensemble conductor. And so I was taking all these classes, and I was really starting to become quite interested in this position, or in this field. Mm-hmm. Well, when I graduated with my master's degree, I knew, okay, it's time to get a job. Like, we got to make, I'm tired of calling home and dad saying, how much do you want? You know, it's like, so I knew I had to get a job. So I actually got a job as a public school teacher. But all the while I was teaching public schools in the summer, I would find these conducting clinics and take part in these conducting clinics. And once I started to really hone in on these conducting skills, and once I started to slowly actually, you know, do conducting, even if it was in high school or I conducted the Coast Guard chamber players. Once I started doing it, I realized that I actually had a talent for it. I felt comfortable in front of an ensemble. I felt comfortable, you know, problem solving, taking the music from the score and bringing it to life. I felt comfortable doing that. And so that's how it really started. It's funny to say that it started like little drum major in high school, but that's when I got the first taste of it and through the rest.
Yeah. We really want to ask you about leadership and go into all of that
sure.
later. But the last thing in this section before I hand it over to Maya is I'm wondering what you wish you had known at our age or what advice you would give to yourself.
Great question. First thing that comes to mind is I wish I had not cared so much about what everybody else thought. Mm-hmm. I wish I just played and just didn't worry about who was judging me and was I playing that right or playing that wrong. I just wish that I had learned that being free with my own voice and my own opinion made me a better musician. And no one ever told me that, you know? I just was so worried about what everybody else thought. I didn't feel like I could be free. So I think that's the best thing I could say.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, especially in classical music, which is so focused on perfection a lot of the time.
Perfection and judgment and don't play it this way, you know? And
right.
It's hard. It's easy for me to say, don't worry about what anybody else thinks, but it's easy for me to say it. And I know that, but I wish I had a little bit more of that feeling of freeness with making music.
That's so funny that you mentioned that because we in our young artists, the class for this
sure.
project actually, we had a class discussion about what are like our internal struggles and like
right.
that we have being in our state right now, specifically
right.
as like a senior and undergrad and figuring
right.
out our little ways in the classical field. And that's
right.
exactly what I said about how like we have to find this balance between, you know, like appealing to the panel
correct.
And to your
correct.
Teachers and mentors
correct.
And doing the correct thing,
that's
but
right.
also having our own voice, like you said, and
yeah.
interpretation and
exactly.
like, and going back to why we're passionate and why we find joy
exactly.
in the freedom of it.
Exactly.
So it's very interesting that you brought that up, and I would agree.
Good.
Anyway, speaking about just that transition and good getting into conducting,
mm-hmm.
I feel like it's a pretty niche, like, you know, getting your reputation and is hard in conducting, I feel
mm-hmm.
like, and starting off
mm-hmm.
might be one of the hardest things
mm-hmm.
within classical. So what was kind of like that process for you for preparing and winning your first conducting role?
Well, the first official conducting position I won was the resident conductor of the wind ensemble. This was back in 2001, and I won't get into the details, but this position opened up. Let's just put it that way. We were going to have a principal conductor of the wind ensemble, and they needed a resident conductor, and that was somebody that was going to be here, preparing the group, on, you know, literally be resident, I always call myself resident gal, you know, just being here and taking care of the group while we had a principal conductor. His name was H. Robert Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
Did you work with him at all, or was he gone before that?
I don't
Bob
think
Reynolds.
So.
Okay, well, he was our principal conductor, and the position was made for him, but part of that was, okay, we need a resident conductor. So they had an audition for it. And, you know, that audition process is the same audition process as it is for you guys when you take audition.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely intense, focused preparation. For me, it was about being so prepared. I memorized Lincolnshire Poesy, which is not an easy piece to memorize, but I had a panel staring at me of, you know, Bob Reynolds, he's a legend, the dean at the time, Larry Livingston, Jimmy Walker was on the panel, Yehuda Gilad was on the panel,
oh
who else? Terry Cravens was on the panel. I had these giant people staring at me while I rehearsed this staple wind ensemble piece, and I think the reason why I won this audition was because I was so prepared that I felt so confident in my own opinions, my own perceptions of how the music should be, that at one point, I just forgot they were there. And so with your audition or your audition, you know, it's the same feeling. If you can feel that 100% preparedness, what I call overwhelmingly prepared, it gives you a confidence to just do the best you can. And you may not win the job. We know that. It's very difficult to win a job. But if you can at least feel prepared and go in there and play with confidence and feel good about it, I'm not just saying it, that's a win. Now, I happened to get lucky and, you know, I did win this position, but it was from that, like I said, overwhelming preparedness that I think is why I won it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember something you said in class, which stuck with me, even though we're amateurs in the conducting world, and we were so nervous for
sure.
Our final.
Sure.
And I remember one of the things you said was, it's good to be nervous, but you don't want to be nervous because you feel not prepared. You want to be nervous because the adrenaline and the excitement almost. And that stuck with me even outside of conducting.
This is great because there are two different types of nervousness. Mm-hmm. Because there was one, somebody was going to ask me about anxiety. I can't remember.
Yes. Yeah, that was my question.
Well, let me just say that there are two different types of nervousness. There's the nervousness that you can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a nervousness where you're not prepared. And I'm sorry, there's nothing you could do about it. When those nerves hit, good luck.
Yeah.
But the other kind, which is what Maya, you are referring to, is the kind of nervousness that when you feel prepared, you can expect it, you can anticipate it, and you can treat it like adrenaline and excitement. And you can visualize controlling it. You can visualize overcoming it. You can anticipate it. I'm gonna be nervous. It's gonna happen. But I got this because I'm ready. That's the kind of nervousness that if I have to experience it, that's the kind I want.
Agreed.
I'm glad you reminded me of that because I'll remind my students that too.
Yeah,
I'm glad that you said that.
Yes. So clearly we know you have been in Thornton as a student.
Mm-hmm.
You have been a faculty for 20 plus years now, which is crazy. So what do you think is special specifically about USC Thornton, it being a university and, you know, it's in Los Angeles? I think that's a very like special environment and place to be, you know, as young aspiring musicians.
Sure.
Like what has kept you here and what do you feel is special and what do you feel attached to?
Well, you already alluded to one thing, and that is we're in the middle of an unbelievably vibrant, culturally vibrant city.
Right.
So we just have access to the biggies of the LA Phils and the Los Angeles Opera Orchestras and the, you know, Pacific Symphonies, and we've got it all, you know, and then we've got all the community orchestras, like, you know, my Downey Orchestra, the Metropolitan Orchestra. We've got all these orchestras and art forms that we can tap into. This is why I'm never leaving this city. I just feel like it's this really special city with regards to what we have, what it has to offer. I mean, the University of Southern California, to me, makes it special because of the people and the people I work with. I mean, this faculty and staff at USC Thornton, there's a reason why people leave and people come back. I mean that. And it's because of the people, and it's because of the shared passion for giving to the students that the faculty have. These are people that I want to be around, and these are people who have kept me here at USC Thornton. And we all have a common goal, and I'm not just saying this, but it's for the betterment of the students. And that's a very simple common goal. And once we keep that in our focus, everything else just falls into place. And so I truly mean that. USC Thornton has kept me here because of the people I work with and the unbelievable students that come through these doors who want to learn, who want to be there. I mean, you guys were in my conducting class, you're in the conducting class here. These are people that have a passion and want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a better way to spend my day is to be with people that are of like passions with me.
Yeah, we definitely feel that as students too, just the amount of support that the faculty has, and like we can feel how much they care.
I
think that really contributes to the sense of community.
Yes.
And something I personally was not expecting is how non-competitive Thornton is, and I think that's really special, especially in the classical music world.
I have heard so many stories of the opposite at other schools.
Yeah.
And I have no interest in any of that competitive crap. I'm sorry to say it, but I don't, you know, and that's why you're right. That's why it makes Thornton such a special place. Very supportive.
I agree. I think healthy competition, even competition within yourself to strive to be better,
of course.
But I'm also glad that it's not in the toxicity sense.
Yes,
of
course.
Like being better than someone else, because that's not a concept and something as subjective as music.
No, and you know that comes from your teachers.
Mm-hmm.
That comes from your teachers.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, and those are the teachers that I work with, and that's the reason for my answer. You know.
Yeah, very special. And then, kind of, just a fun question.
Sure.
Because we've been so music and career driven.
Yes.
We're just wondering, do you have any passions or hobbies or things that you like to do for yourself outside of music and conducting? Because as much as I find it important to, you know, be as involved in the craft that we chose,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's also important to have a life outside of it, enjoy life, because life is more than just art. So do you happen to have any?
I could not agree with you more. I am so happy that you're asking me this question, because I find it crucial to have outside passions.
Right.
I am an absolute sports junkie.
Really?
I am a sport. Go look at my car and you will see, unfortunately, my New York Jets little sticker on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Although we are terrible, I have a big passion for my New York Jets football team. My parents have had season tickets since 1965, so I grew up with green blood, New York Jets blood. I love going to professional sports events.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to my Clippers games. I love going to my LA Sparks games. I love to golf. I have a huge passion to golf. So I would say that is my biggest passion outside of music. I am a literal sports junkie. And I love it. Most of the time.
I guess that, actually.
Except when our Clippers opened the season last night and lost in our brand new stadium, but we won't discuss that.
Oh,
but anyway.
They lost?
Yes. Yes.
Oh. Is that basketball?
Yeah.
Yes,
okay,
yes,
I
it's
don't
basketball.
Even know.
Yes, and see, baseball. I love going to Dodgers games.
Oh, those are
you guys.
So fun.
Yeah, they are. They're really
so
fun. But I think it's important to have a passion outside of music. It keeps us well-rounded, shall we say.
Yeah, great. So going back to leadership,
yes.
Maya and I have both taken your conducting class, which
yes.
I know for me it's been one of the most informative classes I've taken so far at Thornton.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you say it's important for performers to study conducting?
Well, I have a pretty simple answer. And that simple answer is, this is something you are going to have to do at some point in your musical career. I'm sorry, it's one of the only subjects that is going to be a guarantee that you'll have to do. Whether you're in the middle of a string sectional for the South Dakota University Symphony, you're in the middle of a woodwind sectional for the Pasadena College, you're going to have to conduct. You're going to have to feel confident on the podium. You're going to feel like, I have enough technique, I don't teach people I don't produce 10 dudamels in my class or 12 dudamels in my class. I teach people, I hope, the technique to feel confident to lead an ensemble. You're gonna have to do it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
At some point. It's, like I said, one of the only fields of our craft where you're guaranteed, you're at some point, whether it's a little group or a big group. And so that would be my number one reason, simply because it's going to be something that is going to be very useful at some point in your future. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that studying conducting also, if it's taught well, teaches you how to analyze a score. And analyzing a score is very important. You know, when you're out there playing in the ensembles that you're going to be playing in, it's important to know the score. I mean, rehearsals should not just be about knowing your part, but about knowing everyone else's part. And so that's something that taking conducting can teach you. Sure. So, and also, I try to teach leadership skills without really calling them leadership skills. So, you know, Sylvia, in our class right now, every time we get on the podium, even though we know what example you're doing, I make everybody say, well, okay, this is page 99, example number 10. What does it feel like to stand on a podium and have to project your voice and lead people, tell them this is where I'm starting, okay, here we go. I mean, these are leadership skills that you're just gaining every time you're on the podium. So that's why I also think taking conducting is really important.
Yeah, I've noticed even in the past couple of weeks, it's helped me a lot sitting in orchestra and being able to follow you, because I can just say in my head, like, oh, she's going into a subdivided three here.
Right.
And it makes it so much easier.
Right. Those are some of the techniques that I try to teach that hopefully not only benefit you as a conductor, but as a player. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, where it's like, oh my God, I totally look at the conductor differently now, and I understand them better, or whatever. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. So that makes me smile.
And I went to the conducting one class being like, oh, I've never stood once in a podium before. How am I going to memorize a Beethoven score?
Of course.
That's just not in my realm of,
exactly,
you know, possibilities.
Exactly.
But then you end the semester with the 15 or so weeks of,
that's,
you know,
right,
like, just weekly doing the same thing.
That's right.
And the level of, like, confidence and just understanding and awareness that you have is, like...
But that comes from that memorizing of that Beethoven, which can be quite daunting, right? That, mm-hmm, that's a daunting task. But analyzing the score, mm-hmm, figuring out the phrasal structure... This is how, and going poco a poco, section by section, learning the phrase structure, this is how you can memorize, and then all of a sudden, wait a minute, I do remember the flute comes in here. I do remember the bass is coming in here. Wait a second, I can do this. There's another leadership, confidence, you know, and now you're on a podium leading all these people, and you did it, and you have proof. You've got a video to prove it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saved it as soon as it came out.
See? Good.
Yes. And that's perfect that you even mentioned leadership skills and quote-unquote forcing the students in your class to hone in on those leadership,
yes,
skills and prove that they are leaders, because they are.
Yeah.
But why is it so important to have that leadership skill? Because, you know, like, people could just do one thing and just sit in a practice room all day and do what they're told, you know,
sure,
and just be a follower almost.
Sure,
which,
sure, sure.
Which I felt more like when I was, you know, like, learning the gist of, like, my instrument at least.
Sure.
But why is, like, you know, like, showing that you have the capability of being a leader and developing those skills so important?
Well, I think it's important to be a leader, because if we want to save our field of classical music, we're going to need leaders. We're going to need ambassadors. We're going to need well-informed, like I said, ambassadors out there in the world, taking our classical music into the future. If we can keep researching and keep studying our field, we become, like I said, well-informed. Well-informed means having knowledge. Having knowledge is having power. Having power, it leads to having conviction, having passion, having opinions. And these are all values of being a good leader. And we need that.
Yeah.
If we want to continue to keep classical music concerts going, we need to have ambassadors out there for our field. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's important.
Right. Okay. And going back to the earlier topic of kind of anxiety and nerves.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you ever get performance anxiety, and if so, how do you deal with nerves and kind of channel the ability to command both the orchestra and the audience?
Okay, the answer to that question, in all honesty, is I have anxiety about every single concert that I do. I don't care what the level is. I could be doing the Missouri All-State Orchestra. I could be doing the USC Thornton Symphony concert tomorrow night. I could be doing my Downey Symphony. It doesn't matter what the ensemble is. Mm-hmm. This is for me. Everybody's different. My colleague Bob Reynolds, I would say to him, how come you're never nervous? Some people just don't get nervous, and that's great. I'm not one of them. I get nervous for, I don't know if nervous is the right word. I get anxious even for rehearsals. So it goes back to that subject that we were talking about before. The only way I can control that anxiousness and nervousness is by what I call being overwhelmingly prepared. And that's one way of me controlling those anxieties. In all seriousness, you know my rule about eating a banana. That does help. I'm not kidding. And maybe it's psychological. I don't know. But we've always talked about that, you know, that 1 hour, I always tell people there is not one performance that I ever give where I am not eating my banana 1 hour before the performance, because the potassium calms us down, also gives us good natural energy. So I hate to talk about a banana with this question, but I mean, you're asking me and I'm being honest. I mean, that is something, and again, it's a process. It's like, okay, 6:30 tomorrow night, I will start peeling my banana. And maybe that's a psychological way for me that I start calming myself down. I think everybody just needs to find that for themselves. Mm-hmm. But that's mine. And being quiet, I can't be around a lot of noise before a performance. I just can't. Some people can. Mm-hmm. Some people can come right from dinner. I remember last year we had this giant concert with one of our guest conductors with the wind ensemble. And here we are all eating at the faculty center, and it's like, aren't we supposed to be on stage in 20 minutes? Like, that would not be me. That would not be me. I need quiet. Mm-hmm. I need my system, my banana, and that's just how I deal with the anxiety. But it's for me, it's with every performance, every single performance.
That's actually very reassuring to hear that it's not just like something.
It's 100% the truth, mm-hmm. And I don't understand people that don't get nervous. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm not one of those people.
So you would recommend having a routine that
yes.
really works for you, right?
Yes,
before?
Yes. And it, for me, it involves quiet. And breathing, deep breathing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm. Breathing.
Breathing.
I didn't think about breathing until I got to college. I didn't grow up performing, you know, as a kid thinking I have to breathe to feel calm, or breathing while you're playing, or breathing while...
Do you know when I remind myself, or when my friends remind me, just breathe... Do you know how helpful that is just to think of that? There's taking those giant breaths. I don't know how to meditate. This is one of the things I do want to learn how to do. Our French horn professor, Julie Landsman, she does a lot of it. And I want to take some lessons with her. I don't know how to do that, but I do know how to breathe deeply to calm myself.
Maya, do you want to ask the last
one? Yeah, so this is the last question. It might be a little bit similar to kind of like... you know, advice you would give at our age. But in particular, as seniors in ending our first, like, degree, essentially, undergraduate degree, it's a pretty pivotal point. I mean, life is, you know, we could do so much, like, from here, and this is not the end of anything. But specifically at this position, what do you think is the advice that you would want to give, and specifically to, like, undergrad seniors who pursue like a bachelor in music degree, and I'm thinking, you know, some people are going to grad school, some people are freelancing, some people are pursuing a degree in something that they didn't do their bachelor's
for.
You know, there's so many options. And what in particular would you say to them?
You know, I would say, well, first of all, you have to figure out what's best for you. So for me, at the end of my bachelor's degree, I didn't feel ready to start teaching. I was like a 23-year-old kid. I just didn't feel ready to be out there, because I thought I was just going to be a music teacher, right? I thought I was just going to get my degree, go out to the middle school, high school, and teach band or whatever. And so I personally knew that I had gotten really serious on my instrument, and I was starting to really practice more than I had ever practiced. I didn't really practice in high school. I didn't take it as seriously. But when I was at college, I took it really seriously because I had a really good teacher, and you did not show up unprepared. Anyway, so when I figured out at the end of my senior year, you know, I'm playing at a pretty high level. I personally wanted to continue the performing part of it. While I knew I was going to have to get a master's at some point, so I thought, you know what, I better take advantage of my skills as a clarinet player into another degree now. Because if I start teaching and I'm not practicing for a couple years, forget about it, getting back in to get them. So that's why I chose to go right on to do a master's, because of the level I was at, the seriousness I was at, and I was ready to literally master my instrument. And as I told you, from then on, I needed a job. Now, my advice there would be never say no to anything with regards to music. When I finished my master's in orchestral conducting, now this is after I had been teaching, right? I was teaching after my master's in clarinet. I taught for 5 years in the public school system. Then I went back and I got a master's in conducting. When I finished my master's in conducting, what job am I gonna get? But the dean called me and he said, there may be a changeover in the orchestra management position. Would you be, and he couldn't finish the sentence before I said, absolutely. So I actually was the Mike Bassick of, my first job coming out of a master's in fancy orchestral conducting was the orchestra management position. But I couldn't say yes fast enough because I knew it was still music. It was still involved with music, which is my passion. It's not what I wanted to do, but I knew if I start saying no, if I start thinking that these other jobs are beneath me, forget about it. So my advice would be, if it's in music, and even though it's not what you truly want to do, take it, do it. You never know what path it's gonna lead you in. You just don't know.
Right.
And how did it work out for me? I was here, and then the resident conductor position opened up. They didn't even ask me. I asked the dean, I said, can I audition for it? He said, I never even thought of you. I said, well, I want to try it. You know, and that's how I got into that audition, and then the rest is history. So that would be my main piece of advice, is don't ever think that there's a job out there in music that you're too good for. Take it and let the rest ride the wave the way it takes you.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, again, my go-to piece of advice is what I already talked about, and that is just try your best not to worry about what others think. Again, easy to say, but you can't take things personally. You gotta just stick to what you think is right and the way you want it, and go with that. I don't know if you guys have ever read The Four Agreements. This is a book. This is a book by, last name is Ruiz, R-U-I-Z. It's called The Four Agreements. And quite frankly, it changed my life. It's a way of living. The first agreement is make sure that your word is impeccable. And that means not only be honest, but don't gossip. You know, don't say negative things about people. Be honest. Keep your word impeccable. The second agreement is don't take things personally. And I'm like, good luck with that. We all take things personally. But this book changed my life. It taught me that what these people are thinking, that's their opinion. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with my opinion.
Right.
Nothing to do with me and my opinion. I know I didn't do well here, or I know I could have done better there. I know I did great here. I know that this piece should go this way. This is what's important, how I feel. And then the other two agreements are never make assumptions. And the last agreement is always do your best. I just loved this book. So maybe that would be another piece of advice. Take up a book that might help you if you're struggling with some sort of self-doubt or, you know, that kind of thing.
Professor Lavery, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
It was very informative, and it was so nice to be able to talk to you as well.
It's been an honor. Really, really enjoyed it, ladies. Thank you.
Welcome to
Behind the Beat,
a podcast hosted by Sylvia
and Maya.